You are listening to a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Hello, welcome to our podcast, The Signal
and the Noise,
that will attempt to give you a peek into the inner workings of Mint's long story. This is Sunit.
And I am Ajay.
And we are both editors with Mint.
Every week, either one of us will attempt to walk you through the most defining development in the world of business, politics, or technology.
Let's dive in.
Hi, this is Sunit, and my guest today is one of the top watchers of India's famed middle class. He isn't an anthropologist, though many would rate him as one. Santosh Desai, instead, is the managing director of Future Group and looks at consumer culture in India. His long-running column in the Times of India, City City Bang Bang, which is out every Monday, captures key issues of the day, social, political, or otherwise. He has a great book too, Mother Pious Lady, that makes sense of everyday India. I'm speaking to Santosh at a time we are marking the first anniversary of the lockdown, and at a time when the second wave looms over us. I speak to him about how the pandemic has changed the way Indians live, work, eat, pray, and make love. Listen on.
Hi, Santosh. Good to have you on board in The Signal and the Noise.
Pleasure to be here, Sunil.
So, you know, Santosh, a year ago, I wrote a piece where I argued that the pandemic wouldn't change the very essence of being Indian, and it wouldn't alter the way Indians behave. A year later, I'm happy to be proved wrong. So, has anything changed in the year gone by in the way Indians behave, think?
I certainly think there have been changes, but on the other hand, I think I would agree with the underlying spirit of what you said, without necessarily agreeing with the letter of you know, because I do think that there have been changes. I do think there have been changes of several kinds, but I would like to think that the strongest kind of principle that unifies these changes is the fact that changes that were already underway, that the undercurrents of which we could already see and we could already discern, those are the ones that have got amplified, they've got deepened, and they've widened. So, for instance, something like, say, the usage of digital has not only got new users, it has got new uses, it has got categories that earlier, you know, one did not kind of necessarily think of digital very seriously. Those categories are now using it. So, I mean, in terms of behavior, we are becoming much more comfortable with digital technology in a variety of ways. But that's something that we were already seeing. Similarly, our view on health, where you know, we have a more proactive kind of a view of health, and where we are kind of thinking about the idea of immunity and sort of preparing ourselves, you know, against possible sort of ailments. I mean, that kind of a view is something that we've seen certainly kind of become much more prominent during the lockdown and the pandemic. But, you know, it's something that already was underway. So, I mean, to me, the underlying principle, which is the strongest, is of the amplification of undercurrents now becoming more mainstream.
I understand. So, let me break that up a little bit so that we can dive deeper into some of the topics that you mentioned. Let me start with the home as a sanctum sanctorum, work from home. Has the Indians' view about the home changed?
In some ways, I think there has been both a rediscovery of home as well as a new idea of home, both. So the idea of home as sanctum sanctorum, as the place where the family kind of comes together, it engages deeply, is something that, you know, at a certain level as a memory has always existed, and even as a reality, I think it has been true for a lot of Indians. But during this period, I think that became much more real. I mean, the interactions became much deeper with all the attendant kind of consequences. In some cases, families came closer. In some cases, you know, the underlying tensions and fault lines became more sort of visible. But the idea of the home as the bastion of the family, and where the family really gets a very good sense of each other, sort of works as a single unit with the home as the operating kind of base, is something that we've seen much more of during the pandemic. And in a sense, it's a reclaiming of an idea of family, which was weakening as everyone had their own kind of priorities in life. So I think that's one part of it. On the other hand, the idea of the family and the home being a place, a site, of course, in a more physical sense of the office itself, and therefore having kind of new functionalities, so to speak, is the other kind of a discovery that the pandemic has brought forward. But also at a more sort of psychological level, the fact that, you know, whether it was more experimentation in the kitchen and with food, whether it was a greater engagement with domesticity and the idea of the domestic, you know, I think the idea that the meanings, many are more meanings of the home, I think came to the fore. So I think you saw both these kind of shifts. Right.
And once all this is over, and one has to assume that things will get over, there is one prevailing view that in India in particular, that apart from a few sectors, employees will rush back into offices, and therefore the distinction between home and office will reappear. I know predictions are kind of dangerous in this time, but looking forward, what do you think? And looking at the from an Indian point of view.
I mean, I think to some extent that is true. I mean, I think certainly, I mean, nobody can argue that things will continue as they are right now. I mean, that's certainly not going to happen. But equally to argue that things will not change and essentially we will go back to things as they were, I think is probably not true either. But there are certainly sectors and categories beyond the ones that have traditionally had, more blurred lines between work and home, where I think the idea of working from home or at least a greater sort of a willingness to kind of balance out these two needs, a greater willingness to acknowledge the fact that, what was called, which I've always found a strange phrase, work-life balance, because it seems to suggest that work somehow cannot include life and vice versa. Mm-hmm. You know, so the idea of both of these being kind of binary that are somehow sort of, awkwardly sitting together in some form of balance, I think that notion, I think, will get challenged. So I do think that while in a physical sense, it is true that, it's not as if the office will die, but its sanctity will erode. Also, I think the willingness to allow and to acknowledge the fact that work is possible in other modes, that will happen. Also, just from a purely commercial perspective, organizations will find that from a, in terms of real estate costs, actually, it might be quite sort of commercially viable to not insist that everybody comes to office every day. So I do think that because of the fact that there is A, an underlying cultural shift, and B, there is a fairly significant commercial motive, I do think that our attitude toward the office will change.
Okay. I'm going to dial back to the family. Initially, post-lockdown, there were concerns about how women would be affected, and largely women, being subject to, domestic violence. But also, given the declining rates of women in the workforce, women suddenly now have to share, over the last year, have had to increasingly share it with other family members, including the husband, primarily, and children, of course, who weren't going to school. How have you seen the impact there?
I think there are a range of changes there. Again, it's not a single picture that emerges. At one level, it is certainly true that, whenever there is a crisis, women sort of fall out of the workplace more because when there is competition for jobs, then the tendency is for men to get privileged over women. And therefore, apart from other factors, certainly there is a cultural factor at work when it comes to a situation like this. And women, in a sense, lose jobs in much greater numbers and fall out of the workforce. Correct. So I think that certainly has happened. The second is, of course, the question of domestic violence, and that has been, I think, fairly well documented, the fact that is not just in India, but globally, but certainly in India also, that we've seen that there is much greater pressure and there is frustration. People are living in very small spaces. Mm. And the whole relief that came from, people not being together all the time, that relief obviously is no longer available at a time like this. And so we've seen that also. But along with that, we've also seen, two different kinds of things. On the one hand, there is a greater sense of sharing of domestic duties. And I know this is kind of overstated because men like to sort of one day in the kitchen and it becomes a big deal.
They like to preen.
You preen like for days afterwards. And the whole thing about men doing bartan, is something that, for instance, was just all, which just goes to show, how skewed the balance is. But that being said, I think certainly for the first time, there is some sort of an acknowledgement of what it takes to run a house. And just being at home all the time, there is you just get a much more up-close sense of the fact that, this is also a project and an enterprise, which is not easy, particularly when there is, no household help available, which was true for certainly a significant part of the pandemic. So that, I think, is one part of it. And the other, sort of on the flip side, is the fact that women who are used to having at least one domain under their control, a lot of women who, are either working at home or are anyway responsible for the home, even if they be happening to also working outside home. At least there was a full kind of a sense of that being their dominion. I think with a lot of men staying at home, you found also that was challenged, and the fact that now the man, because he's been in the kitchen once, believes that he understands how that works also. So I think there is a little sort of, I think, also a fault line, not very significant, but a fault line nevertheless, that was emerging in terms of control of the domestic sphere. So I think there were a whole range of changes that we saw in this.
Yes. I think, for the last 10 years, the women participation rate in the labor force has been falling. And the general sense is that once a certain level of economic prosperity has been achieved, women are asked to stop working and be at home. And so this is... perhaps, I don't know if this is how it will turn out with the greater financial pressures that this last year has seen and could be further. Maybe women will return to the workforce in higher numbers. I don't know what your sense about that is.
Yeah. So, I think I accept the second part of what you said, but not necessarily the first, because I don't think we have reached the stage, anywhere near the stage where we've reached the stage of affluence where women can kind of, in that sense, afford to drop out of the workforce. Obviously, there will be small sections where that is true. But the larger story certainly doesn't seem to be that. The larger story still is that there is economic pressure. Also, I think it has to be, even if standards of living, even if they were to rise, aspirations are rising at a faster rate. And therefore, the sense that there is a need to pool together as many resources as one can in order to sort of, be able to manage all the aspirations one has. I think that certainly is, the larger truth. So I do think that while that the first part of it may or may not be true, the second part of it certainly is the fact that I think there will be greater economic pressure. Mm. And as we go forward, as opportunities sort of open up, I do think that there will be certainly some a significant return to the workforce as far as women are concerned.
Okay. I was debating whether I'd ask you about the impact on children, because I personally felt that they are hardy and at least my personal experience is in seeing it at home and elsewhere. But let me just ask you this in case you have any insights and any observations on the impact on children.
No, I do think that there has been an impact on children. And I think this is an area, obviously one sort of gets a sense of, and I can't say that for certain, but my sense of it is the fact that there is, the idea of A, being cooped up at home is obviously difficult. Mm. Secondly, the way in which schools and, in particular schools, even colleges, when you function online, actually it increases pressure because, one is sort of, and it increases pressure both on the parent and child unit, both because A, the parent is meant to be available all the time. So, which is, there is much more strain there. And the child, in that sense is captive, and that's not a natural state. The idea of being captive in front of a screen, in such a passive sort of a form. And I think it can be quite stressful for children. And while I think you will see both sides of it, hardiness, a certain ability to kind of not you know, because we've not fully acknowledged what is happening. But there is an anxiety at home, you know, which seeps through. There is a certain, you know, a sort of an invisible kind of a sense of heaviness that hangs on homes. And I think the children pick up on that, I think, you know, quite fast. So I do think that this is something that will affect children, both in, I think, somewhat visible ways as well as we go forward in more invisible ways. Because I think it changes their mental model, I think, of how the future is understood, decoded, and a sense of, just the sense of overall uneasiness, I'm not sure is very healthy, even if children don't really show the signs.
It's interesting that and insightful that you mentioned anxiety and uneasiness with the home, which it's true actually, because I guess children in particular sense underlying tensions and also they have no escape, quote unquote, from duties or just doing things when they're always present in the house. So yes, that's an astute observation. I'm going to step back from the home and individuals for the moment and move to the relationship with the state. You know, post demonetization, there's been a massive increase in the impact of the state in people's lives, and the lockdown, by its very nature, was you know, restrictive. But there were other forms of restrictions too, you know, like the night curfew and so on and so forth. So how do you think the individual's relationship with the state has altered during this period?
Yeah, I think what this period has done is to take further, I think, a shift that was already underway, which is where the state was a much more visible presence, a much more paternalistic figure, you know, I mean, and therefore, very clearly, I think there is a certain degree of sort of territory, if you like, that the state has conquered, you know, even before the lockdown and the pandemic. But I think the pandemic has taken that further. The fact that a lot of it became discretionary. I think, you know, and that's the interesting thing about the state's transgression into areas that it earlier did not kind of have a presence in. A lot of it comes out of, you know, which is voluntary. I mean, surveillance, for instance, you know, beginning with traffic and all the cameras that you see around, I mean, is something that is, for most part, welcomed by people as a, you know, as something that, you know, is a facility, is an advantage.
CCTV cameras.
Exactly. I mean, the CCTV cameras that you see every day, I mean, that's a sign of development. It's not seen to be inclusive. Similarly, I think the fact that when the state mandates certain restrictions here, it gets decoded not as intrusion, which and because in a situation like this, you know, that is necessary in most cases. So what happens is that there is a creeping kind of a sort of a, there is a, you know, creeping acquisition of territory, if you like, that has been underway, and it gets legitimized because, you know, under the circumstances, what option is there? Most people would argue. So I think to that extent, the state's shadow has grown longer and darker, I think, in this case.
There's a wider ambit around the term public good, which actually gets accepted. And I think you're right. And it's just via technology has also increased. And right. There's also and also an impact in particular on one part that I'm keen to get your observations on the informal sector, where, you know, again, demonetization dealt a deadly blow there. But today, the informal sector is reeling by all, you know, reported, you know, insights. What are you picking up about the impact of the lockdown on the informal sector?
Well, I mean, it has been devastating. I think there is no question about the fact that, you know, with people without any sort of ways of supporting themselves, with there are no safety nets of any kind. And when entire large sort of swaths of categories, I mean, the huge sort of, you know, livelihoods of in many, many, many professions get virtually sort of suspended, and not just for a few days, but for now, you know, in some cases, almost a year now, and certainly for many months, almost entirely. I mean, there is nothing to, you know, there are, you can't dig into some, anything that you have. There is nothing to fall back on. And so I think for the informal sector, I think this has been a devastating blow. I think the reason why you saw the kind of reverse migration and the rush to sort of return, I think, was an index of the fact that there was that the only possible sanctuary at that kind of a time is to go back, to your home and make do with whatever exists there. The truth is that not much exists there, which is the reason why you've left your home in the first place. So there are no institutional mechanisms available. There is not very much available by in terms of, you know, government programs in the here and now, you know, that can be of help. So I think when you put that together, I do think that this has been a really, really devastating kind of a blow for the informal sector.
There's also been an increase in all forms of divide, of course, moneyed, formal, informal, and of course, rural and urban divide. And there's a lot of the pandemic has been concentrated in urban centers. And I remember conversations with you in the past where we have talked about smaller changes in rural India and smaller town India. I don't know if whether you have had the time or been able to move out and get feedback, but what are you picking up from rural India as well as small town India? I'm using both the terms.
Yeah, I have actually had some opportunity. I mean, obviously very limited, but some opportunity to actually largely sort of drive through places and to spend some time in smaller towns. So my sense of it is that, A, of course, the impact is on the surface much less visible because, you know, the fear and anxiety that you find in the larger cities, particularly in the earlier stages, was conspicuous by its absence as you traveled out of the largest city. So there is a certain sense of, I think, life going on as normal. And I think there the biggest disruption was actually the return of the migrant. I mean, that was, in that sense, the most visible disruption that one saw. And even if you were to look at some of the data around, say, things like, say, newspaper advertising and category sales, etc., you'd find that the smaller towns have, relative to the larger towns, held their own much better. So in some sense, this has been a reversal of the normal kind of a sort of the impact that you see in any crisis where the most sort of badly affected tend to be the smaller towns and the larger towns have some sort of a safety net. I think in some senses, there has been a reversal. Of course, the margin there that is available is much lower. The return of the migrants did put a fair amount of pressure in rural areas. But on the whole, this is my, you know, and it, like I said, it's not based on too much. So I would not sort of, you know, beyond a point assert that this is the truth. But it does seem to me that the smaller towns and rural areas relative to the larger cities, I think but the disruptions were perhaps a little less visible.
Finally, getting back to more primal matters, has the lockdown and the pandemic affected the bedroom and sex in any particular way amongst Indians? Are you picking up anything there? Are you getting any research there?
There's some sense and a lot of speculation. In the best of times, you know, this is not an area that one tends to get too much of a sense of. But right. But I do think that this is a, you know, certainly you would have found, certainly, you know, I mean, you know, of the few entertainment options available, I certainly think that this would be a prominent one. So I would be surprised if this was, we did not see, you know, much greater intimacy of a kind, you know, and we did not see much more activity in this area. I would certainly think that this would be a time for, just like those, you say, you would experiment with the things that were available to you. I think we saw that when it came to food. And I have, therefore, a sense that perhaps we saw that also when it came to sex.
Great. Thanks, Santosh. Insightful as always.
You have been listening to The Signal and the Noise. We would love to hear from you. Reach out to us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram on @HTSmartcast.
Or you can also reach out to us personally at Sunita Arora
and @AJAxiom. To listen to more such interesting podcasts, do log on to htsmartcast.com.
We'll be back next week with a new story, another fresh voice, or a unique take on the world.
Do stay well until then, and keep supporting good journalism.
This was a Mint production brought to you by HT Smartcast.
HT Smartcast.